8. June 3rd, continued. I woke up before dawn with an inspiration, an idea how to make a salad. What brought it to me was a dream I was having of my mother carrying a wicker basket, walking across a field and into a woods. When I woke, I realized what she was doing. She was getting cress, dandelion greens, and poke greens, as she always did early in June. On the edge of the far field, beyond the pond, they grow wild. Field cress looks about like watercress, and, mixed with dandelion greens, it makes good green salad. The poke greens you have to cook, but when they are young, they are rather like spinach. When they get old, however, they are bitter and can be poisonous. My mother used to gather them every spring, carrying a basket to put them in, and David, Joseph, and I used to go with her, and Pharaoh, of course. I had forgotten all about that until now, which shows that dreams can be helpful. I got excited about the idea and jumped out of bed. I knew exactly where the basket was, on a shelf in the kitchen cupboard, and where the greens grew. Not only was I hungry for greens, but I thought Mr. Loomis must be even hungrier, since he could not possibly have eaten anything like that in more than a year, while I, at least, had had last summer's garden. I started to get the basket, and then I remembered his nightmare and my worry that he might be sick, so I went downstairs very quietly and listened outside his bedroom door, which was still open. He seemed to be sleeping peacefully. His breathing was quiet and even, so I decided it was safe to go. I would not be gone very long anyway. I took the basket from the shelf, got a glass of milk from the cellar, where I keep it, with the eggs and butter, because it is always cold, drank it, and went out. I would cook breakfast later. It was cool, but still unpleasant. Not yet very light, though it was almost 7 o'clock. The sun would not come over the ridge until about 8. I walked along the road past the pond, and then turned left across the field. Pharaoh came with me, sniffing everything. The grass was wet, and my sneakers quickly got soaked through. So did the bottoms of my blue jeans, so I rolled them up to my knees. Still, I felt happy. Behind me in the pond, I heard a big fish, a bass, jump and fall back into the water with a thump. I thought, after I get the cress and the other greens, I will cook breakfast and then go fishing. With luck, I might catch a bass or two to have for dinner with the salad. I would make a dressing of oil and vinegar and cook some fresh biscuits. I was getting near the far side of the field when all of a sudden Pharaoh came to a point, tail straight, paw lifted, nose forward. I was amazed. Could it be possible that there were quail still in the valley? I could not believe it. I had heard none, and they have a call that cannot be mistaken. I inched forward behind the dog, and a rabbit went bounding away in the high grass. David used to scold Pharaoh for pointing rabbits, but I did not. After all, there was nothing else to point, and rabbits are good to eat. So I patted him instead and said, "Good, Pharaoh." I knew he was disappointed that I had no gun. I found the field cress and dandelions, and beyond, where the woods began, the poke, just out of the ground, young and edible. In half an hour, I had picked enough to fill the basket. I could have filled two. Then I had an illusion. The basket of green leaves suddenly seemed to be giving off a beautiful sweet perfume, but that was impossible. So I looked around to see where the smell was coming from, and there, 20 feet ahead of me on the edge of the woods, was a crab-apple tree in full bloom. I had known the tree was there. We used to eat the apples sometimes, and my mother used them for jelly. They had a nice flavor, though they were small, hard, and quite sour. There are better eating apple trees behind the barn. But I had never known the tree to look so beautiful or smell so nice. I supposed it seemed that way because the air was still, and the fragrance just hung there, concentrated instead of blowing away on the wind. And because the light was still dim, a morning twilight, the branches and all the white blossoms looked misty and delicate, an almost magic look. I walked a few steps closer and then sat down, right in the wet grass, to stare. I thought, if I ever got married, apple blossoms were what I would like to have in the church, which meant that I would have to get married in May or early June. I got to thinking about it. Next June, I would be 17, and in my entire life, I had only had one real date, and that was when I was 13 in junior high school. A boy named Howard Peterson asked me to go with him to a dance at the school. My mother took me, it was in Ogdentown, and stayed for the whole dance, sitting on the side with some other mothers. The only way you could tell it was a date was that Howard paid for both the tickets, 50 cents each. I have had other boyfriends, but I only saw them at school or after school. The truth is, in high school, most of the boys lived in Ogdentown, and those of us who came on the bus were regarded as outsiders, hillbillies, in fact, and not fashionable. So, to me, the idea of getting married seemed like quite an enormous step. Still, I thought, when Mr. Loomis recovered from his sickness, there was no reason why we could not plan to be married in a year. That is, next June, perhaps on my 17th birthday. I knew there could not be any minister, but the marriage ceremony was all written out in the back of the hymnal. There should be a ceremony. I felt strongly about that, and it should be in the church, on a definite date, with flowers. The whole idea was thrilling. I thought I might even wear my mother's wedding dress. I know where it is, folded up in a box in her closet. Then it occurred to me, Mr. Loomis had not indicated the slightest interest in any such idea. But of course it was much too soon, and he was very sick. We would talk about it when he had finally recovered. And I thought, what would it be like 10 years from now to be up here gathering greens some morning with children of my own? But that thought made me feel lonesome for my mother, a feeling I have tried hard to avoid. So I stood up to change the subject. I got out my pocket knife and cut a bunch of apple blossoms. Mr. Loomis could have a bouquet for his sick room. I started back to the house. On the way, the sun appeared over the ridge, but some clouds followed it almost immediately, and the chill stayed in the air. That was good, because I still had the rest of the garden to plant, and since it was late in the season, the cooler the weather stayed, the better it would do. At the house, everything was quiet. I put the flowers in a vase and the greens in the cold cellar. It would be for dinner, in the nature of a surprise. Then I cooked breakfast, eggs, canned ham, and some pan biscuits. I really wished then that I had that wood stove moved in from the barn so that I could have a real oven and do some proper baking. I decided that I'd try those bolts soon and see if I could dismantle it. I put the breakfast and the vase of flowers on a tray and knocked on his door, which was partly open. There was no answer, so I pushed it wider, looked in, and learned why the house was so quiet. He was not there. Immediately I was worried, very worried. I realized that it was stupid of me to have left him alone, knowing that he had had the nightmare, knowing that it might have been the beginning of the high fever. He might be right now, wandering somewhere in a delirium. In the house? I called, but there was no answer. I put the tray down, setting the breakfast near the fire where it would stay warm, and ran to the front door. It was all right. I saw him immediately, across the road, not far from Burden Creek, sitting on a large round stone. He had the Geiger counter with him, the one with the earphone. He was staring at the creek, looking upstream. I walked over to him, and he looked up when he saw me coming. He said, "I thought you had run away." "Are you all right?" I was still worried. "Yes," he said. "In fact, I woke up feeling so much better that I began to wonder about this water, whether maybe you had read the meter wrong, or whether the counter was off. So I walked over to check it with this one." Oh, I hoped I had read it wrong. I had never hoped anything so much. But I had not. He went on, "It was no use. Your reading was right. There's just no way I could have got less than 300 R's. He must have felt disappointed, but he said it calmly. As before, he did not sound frightened. I said, "I wish I had been wrong." "It's no worse than before," he said. "It was just a hope. Anyway, since you weren't here, I sat down and started thinking about that stream." "Thinking what?"
"It's radioactive, there's no doubt about that. But there's no reason it shouldn't be useful. Up there."
He pointed to a place 100 feet upstream, a rocky place where a big boulder blocked the creek and made a little waterfall.
"They're sort of a natural dam. It looks as if somebody sometime even tried to add to it."
"That's true," I said. "My father said that my great-grandfather had a small mill there, a flour mill. He thought the stone you're sitting on was part of it. It's worn so smooth."
What I was thinking about was not a mill, but electricity. If I could build that dam up a few feet higher, there's a good flow of water. It could run a small generator.
But we don't have any generator. Anyway, if we tried to build a dam, we'd get the water on ourselves. It's too dangerous.
Not if I was wearing the safe suit, and if I was careful. And the generator is easy. You can make one out of any electric motor, with a little tinkering.
But where would we get an electric motor? Then I remembered. There were two or three of them in the barn, in my father's workshop. One, I know, was hooked up to a grindstone, another to a circular saw. I told Mr. Loomis, and he smiled.
There are always motors around a farm. The hard part will be the water wheel. But I think I can make one. I'll need some lumber and some kind of an axle. It won't be fancy, but it will work.
Would it light the lights?
Yes, they might be a bit flickery, but they'd light. Mainly, it would run your refrigerator, your freezer, things like that. They don't use much current.
It would be nice to have a refrigerator again. And a freezer? I could freeze vegetables and fruit for the winter.
That reminded me. His breakfast was drying up by the fire, and I had had nothing to eat yet myself, except some milk and a couple of sprigs of field cress.
After breakfast, I milked the cow and planted some more of the garden. Melons, beets, and several rows of beans. I had some seed potatoes left. They looked pretty dried up, but I felt so optimistic and energetic I planted them anyway. They might revive. Then I went to the house to get my fishing rod and to tell Mr. Loomis, lying down, I was going to the pond. He sat up on the side of the bed. He said,
"Do you think?"
I waited.
"Well, I'd like to go with you."
"To fish?" I was torn. It would be fun to have him go, but the pond is more than a quarter of a mile off. "How is your fever?"
"About the same. About 100. Not so bad."
"It's chilly out."
"I could take a blanket."
"I'll get you a coat." In the hall closet, I found an old cloth raincoat of my father's. I thought it would not do him any harm, and it was something for him to do.
"Do you really want to fish?" I asked him. He looked embarrassed. "I never have. I don't know how."
"I can show you. It's very easy, at least the way I do it. I just put a worm on the hook and throw it in. Sometimes I use a float, sometimes not."
"A float?" He really did not know how to fish.
"A little ball made of cork." I pulled one out of my pocket and showed him. "It keeps the hook off the bottom."
"Have you got an extra one?"
"Yes," I said, "and I can get David's rod." It was in his closet. We started out for the pond, with him wearing my father's coat and carrying David's fishing pole. But we did not make it. After about 100 yards, he began walking very slowly. Soon he stumbled and dropped the rod.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I can't go on."
He had turned extremely pale, a bluish color. He looked terrible. "Lean on me," I said. "Leave the rod. We'll go back."
"It's the anemia," he said. "I should have known. It's the dependable part of the disease. 5 to 7 days after exposure. This is the 7th day.
We started back very slowly. He could hardly stand up. I said, "You'd better lie down."
"Yes."
He sank to the grass at the side of the road, lay on his back, and closed his eyes. But his color slowly got better. "It came so suddenly," I said.
"No, it was the walking. I knew I had it a little."
"What should I do?"
"Nothing. Help me back to the house, then go fishing."
So I did that. When we got back to the house, I sat beside his bed for a while, and then went on to the pond. But it was a nervous and disappointed kind of fishing. He had explained that the anemia would not get any worse, but it meant that he would not be able to do much now until he had gone through the whole illness and recovered. Then it should gradually go away. Still, I felt as if it was the beginning of the end. No, not the end, but of a bad time, and all my plans of this morning seemed thoughtless and foolish. I fished just long enough to catch 3 bass, about 30 minutes. Fortunately, they were biting. Then I went back. He did seem better again, and even got up and sat at the table for lunch, though I noticed that he moved slowly and rather cautiously, and after he had eaten, he lay down again immediately.
When I looked into the bedroom a little later, he was asleep. I put a fresh glass of water by his bed. I kept thinking about the stove, so while he slept, I went down to the barn, got from my father's workshop a wrench, a pliers, a screwdriver, and a hammer, and went to work. To my surprise, the stove came apart fairly easily. The oil I had put on the bolts last winter had done the trick. Even so, I broke a couple of fingernails, but by sunset I had it lying in pieces on the barn floor. I found I could lift all of the pieces but one, the big cast-iron firebox. Even with the grates and door removed, that was too heavy. However, I could turn it end over end, and by doing that get it onto a sheet of masonite I found in my father's workshop. Since the masonite is slick on one side, I made sure that side was down, I could drag it a ways, using the masonite as a sled. I intended to back the cart right up to the barn door and try to get the grate that far on the sled, and then onto the cart. If I couldn't, I would just have to wait until Mr. Loomis was well and could help. I did not actually try it, because by the time I had it ready, it was time to milk the cow, then clean up and start the dinner. In spite of everything, dinner was festive, with the bass, the fresh-cooked greens, and the salad. It is incredible how good fresh green things can taste when you have not had any for months, or in Mr. Loomis's case, more than a year. I set the table with the good china that my mother saved for Sundays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and birthdays. I did forget one thing, candles. I had had some in the house, but took them to the cave. There are more at the store, but I did not think of it until too late. However, the oil lamps gave a pleasant light. They just did not look as romantic. We ate all of the bass and all of the greens and salad, though there was enough for four. After dinner, it being still cool, I built up the fire again. I had found some books that interested Mr. Loomis, a set called The Farm Mechanic. I had discovered them on a shelf in the workshop in the barn. The set was an annual publication, like the World Almanac, and each is full of diagrams of motors, wiring systems, pumps, silos, balers, and so on. He studied them, there were 8 volumes, for a long time. I could tell he was figuring out how to build the generator, and maybe making other plans as well.